This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:31 p.m. on Monday, February 7, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure you have a transcript of our meetings, and Alex Beebe Gudice from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, Representative Eastman, my vice chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Bill 159, Consumer Data Privacy Act, sponsored by the House Rules Committee. By request of the governor, this will be the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Fields and his staff, Tristan Walsh. Please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Thanks, Chair Clayman. Zach Fields, House District 20.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields.
Zach Fields, again, for the record. House Bill 159, which was written by the Department of Law. We spent a ton of time on this bill in Labor and Commerce, and as the vice chair knows, went through many iterations trying to make sure that the bill is targeted appropriately, addresses what I think is a very real public policy problem, namely the sale and use of people's private information through online commerce, and then has adequate enforcement mechanisms, which I think adequate enforcement is particularly challenging in a state like Alaska. So I think it's fair to say that the administration introduced a bill. We substantially rewrote it. The last CS we passed out, Labor and Commerce, the administration had no comment on. So they've sort of, I would say, disengaged from it, and we've tried to move the ball down the field. I think there was good reason to introduce the bill, and I think the bill that you have before it is greatly refined from that original House Bill 159. So with that, I'll get into what some of those details are. What does this bill do? It establishes a responsibility of data brokers to inform consumers when they're going to be collecting their data and to ensure that there's consumer consent. It establishes specific rights of consumers, the right to request what information was collected, the right to request a list of who that data was shared with, the right to request that certain information not be shared, sold, or disclosed, and the right to request their information be deleted. Good luck getting anything of these things done by an internet company today. This bill adds protection for the data of minors, which is, to me, a glaring omission in our statutes. This bill has two very strong provisions for enforcement, one, a private right of action, two, standing up real capacity within the Alaska Department of Law to enforce this law, within the Alaska Department of Law to enforce what would be a new statute. It's very important to note that some of the major and most, I think, technically challenging pieces that we worked on in Labor and Commerce were making sure that the provisions in this bill are targeted to those companies that are actually buying and selling consumers' data. We heard from a wide range of bona fide businesses in Alaska that didn't want to inadvertently be exposed to sort of gotcha lawsuits or unnecessary regulation because they're not in this realm of business or because they're already regulated by other federal statutes. So we did work really closely with bankers, insurance companies, logistics companies to make sure that the provisions of this bill, which are strong, are narrowly targeted. And I think that's really important. Finally, this bill allows for consumers to use a global privacy signal or control. What's that? That's where you have a setting on your phone or your computer that says, hey, you can't collect my information to the myriad websites that you as a consumer are going to interact with. One of the things that I think we have to take into account when we're looking at something like data privacy is sort of behavioral realities in the marketplace. You know, if we structure the law so that it's easy for consumers to have their information protected, their information is more likely to be protected than if we make it extremely difficult and cumbersome for them to protect that information and make it all too easy for internet companies to have them opt out of it with a click of a button. If we're making it easier for consumers to give away all their rights with a click of a button, we haven't really done anything. And that's one thing that we put a lot of energy into thinking through on Labor and Commerce Committee, and heard from some experts in the privacy field about how we accomplish that goal. I think it's important to recognize that we have some pretty clear constitutional directive here to protect people's privacy, and obviously the reality of technology, communication, commerce was very different when the constitutional delegates convened over 60 years ago. So, why do we need to provide some protection to consumers on sharing, buying, and selling personal information? Well, some of the world's largest technology companies have a record of doing this in a way that most people would find egregious. There are also smaller companies, some of these data brokers, that I would characterize as parasitic actors in the online marketplace, and they absolutely abuse people's privacy. That's why. It's very well documented. I think the last year, with some very detailed whistleblower information from Facebook in particular, shows a need for it. There's a very interesting New York Times article just 2 days ago. The number of Facebook's customers went down for the first time. Some of their revenue streams went down. Why? Because some of Apple's phone products provide some of the consumer protections that I think should be provided across platforms. And the end of that article, Apple CEO Tim Cook says, "The online marketplace has become a realm of hucksters and criminals." Pretty strong words from a tech CEO. So I think when you look at the Apple phone settings and consumers' use of them, it shows a very strong latent demand for privacy protections. Why would those privacy protections not be available on an Android device or a computer? That's our responsibility. It's really important to understand that when some of these data brokers, when a company like Facebook says that they collect your information, but it's anonymous, that's not true. Extensive journalistic work shows that it is extremely easy, using the aggregation of data, to de-anonymize that data at the risk of individual safety. So number one, if a company is going to tell you that, it should be true. Number two, there are very real personal safety implications, and we're going to get into some detail about what that looks like later on. Basically, you can de-anonymize very large data sets and discover that, yes, Chair Clayman actually, was at the cars at Benson and Northern Lights, and then he went to a Women's March protest on the Park Strip, and then he went home. Like, journalists have documented following lots of people who could do that, and the fact that that is possible by anyone, not a national security employee, but anyone, shows how at risk people's personal information is. More on the why about it mattering if people's personal information is bought and sold. Number one, there have been stunning and disturbing growth rates in teen suicide and teen anxiety related, strongly correlated to use of social media products, where these social media products are using people's information and then pushing them into consuming more information that is demonstrably dangerous. Number two, when these companies can acquire, buy, and sell information, it can perpetuate systemic racism in a wide range of areas. Number three, when it comes to our reproductive privacy, frankly, this is not something where consumers should have their private information out on the marketplace unless they consent to it. Finally, it is a very real safety risk when easily de-anonymized personal data can allow anyone to track where you are at any time. So I think this is an animation. I'm going to try to play it. The New York Times, this was 2 years ago. The New York Times figured out using aggregate data sets how to track a DOD official about where he went. That white dot is an official and his wife. The New York Times found this out. A journalist using publicly available information. Why would that be risky? Well, there are issues of restraining orders, stalking, domestic violence, and sexual assault. There are a lot of reasons that we as Alaskans don't want anyone to be able to track any one of us at any given time just based on data that's out in the marketplace. So it's very well documented that the data is easily de-anonymized. Getting into some of the risks of this, particularly in our state, some apps that people commonly use share very personal information. When consumers should have the option of using these apps, I also think it's reasonable that these apps should not be disclosing people's personal information without the consumer's clear consent. Do we have the Vice motherboard on the stalking example in here on geolocation data?
No.
Okay. So just to finalize this risk of sharing de-anonymized personal information as it pertains to location, there have been documented examples of where stalkers have tracked down their victim using this de-anonymized location data. It's a real safety issue. The Vice motherboard site did a very detailed story about it, and I should have included it in that slide. But this is not theoretical. It's happening right now. So as we were developing this bill, we looked at some other states that have passed privacy legislation. California was one of the first. When you look at the bill that the Department of Law wrote, it cut and paste would be overly simplified, but it very closely mirrored California's data privacy law, which has undergone several updates. So what are some of the things in the California data law that I think we should include? Private right of action for enforcement? Absolutely, yes. Consumer rights? Yes. Employment protections? Yes. We have a different threshold than the California law, and this is really important. Look at that California threshold, $25 million in revenue. There are a lot of companies in Alaska that have way more than $25 million in revenue that aren't buying and selling people's personal information, and frankly, that don't need a large new regulatory burden to navigate. So we changed the threshold to be more than 50% of revenue and data of more than 100,000 people. If you don't have both, none of the provisions of this bill apply to you. And that's really important because we're not trying to regulate a moose's tooth or a construction company or REI or a logistics company or an oil company or any of these other companies that all of these companies have people's information, right? Their employees, their customers. They're not selling them. They're not revealing them. They aren't the problem. And if they aren't the problem, we don't need to overregulate them. Getting this threshold right was, I would say, one of the central focuses in the Labor and Commerce Committee. Now, you can look at some other states and see what are some of their different models. Virginia and Colorado don't have a private right of action. So our bill does. Why do we have a private right of action? In Alaska, I don't think we have a single attorney who's has the expertise to bring a lawsuit on one of these cases should a company, say a Facebook, violate a law that we pass. We don't have anyone in the Department of Law with that expertise. We don't have a private attorney. So realistically, to protect Alaskans' consumers' rights, that would be through a class action lawsuit brought by one of the experts. And I think we should develop that expertise in Alaska. I think we should develop that expertise in the Department of Law. It doesn't exist right now. So a private right of action is very important. However, it's also important that the private right of action be limited to those companies actually doing this business and that we not inadvertently expose companies and other areas of business to sort of gotcha suits that just seek a quick settlement. Enforcement. And this gets to building our capacity. So we have a private right of action. That's important. We've heard that from privacy experts. And I know Ms. Mahoney is on the line and can speak more to that. We also have a consumer privacy account in the general fund. So we would establish a new user fee financed privacy account to build up that expertise in our Department of Law and have, in a democratic institution, lawyers who can actually enforce this thing. Because we've seen in other parts of the world, if it's not enforceable, we might as well not go to the trouble. And, you know, the reality is we're not Silicon Valley, unlike certain other states, say Virginia or California. We don't have a cadre of lawyers who have this expertise already. We've got to build it up. We have to sustain it over time. And I don't think it would be fair to do that, to tax sort of random people or other businesses. This should be a user fee finance model to ensure compliance. And by the way, when individuals have confidence their personal information is going to be safe online, I actually think it encourages commerce in a healthy way because people have more confidence in the marketplace. So our bill has a two-pronged enforcement mechanism, private right of action, and a user financed, that is the companies finance it, enforcement mechanism within the Department of Law. And I think both are important. Who are some of the stakeholders who help provide feedback on this bill? Electronic Frontier Foundation, Electronic Privacy Information Center, Consumer Reports, Ashkin Soltani, who now heads the California Privacy Bureau, Linden, banking companies and insurance providers. So we had input from privacy advocates, and we had input from businesses in Alaska to make sure that we weren't inadvertently creating a regulatory burden for companies that don't even do this anyway. With that, I'm happy to answer questions, and I really appreciate the time that a fairly large group of people have put in this bill. Not just us, but, Emma Potter, who was a session staff person working with me last session, she and Tristan Walsh have put literally hundreds of hours into this bill. Experts like Ms. Mahoney and Ashkin Soltani and many others have put an immense amount of time into this bill, and we've heard in previous testimony in Labor and Commerce that if passed, this would be the strongest privacy bill in America. And I think, you know, given the constitutional support for privacy in our Constitution, that's something we should advance. Thank you.
And actually, before we get to questions, we're going to have one person that's been asked to join us online for invited testimony. That's Maureen Mahoney. I think she's with us on Teams. Ms. Mahoney, if you want to make your comments, we generally try to limit testimony to 3 minutes and see if you can confine your comments to that range, although you may get questions later. And just introduce yourself for the record as well.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Maureen Mahoney, and I'm a senior policy analyst at Consumer Reports. And we very much appreciate your work to advance consumer privacy by considering this bill. Now is the time to pursue strong consumer privacy legislation. I think that most consumers would be shocked to know that there's no federal across-the-board law that governs the privacy and security of their personal data. And because of irresponsible data practices, guardrails are needed now more than ever. Consumers are constantly tracked online and offline, and unrestricted data collection has allowed companies like Google and Facebook to grow into huge entities that are largely unregulated. This bill would provide strong privacy protections for consumers. We particularly appreciate that it would protect consumers' privacy by default. Companies will be limited in what they can collect, use, and share to what's reasonably necessary to provide the service requested by or consented to by the consumer. And this is a significant step up from the FTC's notice of choice regime, where companies describe their practices in incomprehensible disclosures, and it's left to the consumer to either take it or leave it. It's also better than measures in other states that are based entirely on an opt-out model, requiring consumers to contact hundreds, if not thousands, of different companies in order to fully protect their privacy, which simply isn't workable. And this bill addresses those problems by including strong data minimization and a global opt-out to stop any additional due disclosures in a single step. The strong definitions in the bill are important in making sure that the data protections are real. This is important because in California, businesses have exploited a weaker definition of sale to continue to engage in the transfer of consumers' data for commercial purposes in spite of the opt-out. And finally, the strong enforcement provisions in the measure are important to incentivize companies to comply. Otherwise, companies might be incentivized to disregard the law. There have been significant problems with compliance in Europe with respect to the GDPR. And thank you again for the opportunity to speak today. We'd welcome any questions.
Thank you very much. So we're going to open it up to questions for the committee. As usual, we're going to limit committee members to 1 minute per question. And I'd also note that also available, I think she's online, is Terry Bannister. Yes, she is, from Legislative Legal Services. And I saw some hands up. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Fields, this is very exciting. How long have the other states with strong models been in existence? And I was originally going to ask, is Alaska, with its small population, going to be able to impact this field? But it sounds like others are already into it, so it shouldn't be a big deal. I mean, if the biggest economy in the country, in the state of California, has these protections in place, it should be fairly simple for Alaska to join that.
Yes, through the chair, I think I'll answer that question in a couple of different ways. I don't remember the exact year California passed its first data privacy law. It was a few years ago, and since that time, basically every year they've refined it. And I'd be happy to turn to Tristan Walsh or Ms. Mahoney to provide greater detail on the first year and each of those updates. There have been multiple updates. And then looking across the states, we have four examples up here of states that have passed or are contemplating laws. Colorado, Virginia, California passed them, of course. Florida also has a pretty strong privacy law. Many other states of all different population levels are contemplating such laws. it's very clear that the federal government, as far as I can tell, is not going to pass strong data privacy protections. Not going to happen. I wish it would. It's not. So if it's not, then states are the only option. And I think when you look at the states that are contemplating it, there are basically two models. You'll see the very same companies with AstroTurf organizations that don't want to regulate and protect people's privacy. They will be advocating for legislatures to pass privacy laws. I put that in air quotes, privacy laws that do nothing to protect the privacy of consumers, that would allow legislators to walk and say, oh, we passed a privacy law. It doesn't actually do anything. They'll absolutely be working to have states pass those. So I think you're going to see states go down one of two roads. You're going to see them take a real meaningful approach to privacy, and then you'll see other states sort of take industry-written bills that are toothless. And over time, you're going to see more and more states legislate, and I think you're going to have a critical mass of states that have strong laws, and it's a reality of internet commerce that I think even a small state will force companies to have more reasonable protections, because it's not going to be workable for companies to have, you know, stronger protections in Alaska and weaker protections in Colorado. We have a real opportunity, not just to protect Alaskans, but to set out a strong policy model and protect and provide protections that are that could be broader than our state.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair, now, I was not aware that we could have a bill that was jointly sponsored by two different House committees. Normally, I would expect a motion on the floor to change from one committee to the other sponsorship. How did we get to the point where we have the Rules Committee and Labor and Commerce both as kind of the sponsors on this bill?
Through the chair, I'm not the sponsor of the bill. I'm presenting the bill to this committee. And I think it's a reality that administrations introduce lots of bills. This is among the most complicated. And it's now in the legislature, and it's our job to figure out what the best policy is. And I appreciate the work that the Department of Law did in putting it together and providing input in labor and commerce. And, you know, if they have time, I think their further input on the bill, I'm sure, would be welcome.
Follow-up.
Representative Eastman.
So, actually, not the question I was asking. How did the Labor and Commerce Committee name come to appear on the bill? It says by the House Labor and Commerce Committee.
Oh, that's because we through the chair. That's because we adopted a CS, as is normal for an administration bill coming to a committee.
Okay, thank you. Follow up.
Representative Eastman, are we still on this procedural question?
No.
We're getting to the substance of the bill now.
So on the substance of the bill. Are the protections that we have in this bill, are they weaker or stronger than in other states?
Through the chair, I think I'll actually defer that to Ms. Mahoney, who provided testimony on this point in a previous committee, because I have strong opinions about the merits of my bill, but maybe a third party might have more credibility. Thank you.
Ms. Mahoney, compared to other states. Is she with us? She seems to be frozen on the screen.
Take a vote.
Brief at ease. Record. Ms. Mahoney, can you hear us now?
Chair, yes, I can hear you now.
And did you hear Representative Eastman's question?
I believe the question was, is this bill stronger than what's in other states?
Exactly, yes. If you could compare this the proposal in front of us with other states that have passed similar laws.
Yes, of course. Thank you. So in my view, this would be the strongest commercial privacy bill in the United States if it's adopted. One improvement over California is that it has this strong data minimization provision that limits collection use and disclosure to what's reasonably necessary to provide the service requested by the consumer. In contrast, in California, there are next to no limits on the amount of data that companies could collect. So this provides a lot more default protections and you know, this provides additional security protections because having that much collected data is a security risk with respect to hackers. And it does have stronger enforcement provisions, in my view, than in California. There's a private right of action for certain parts of the bill in California, but there are significant exemptions from the private right of action, particularly with respect to the privacy provisions. This bill is far stronger than what was adopted in Virginia, because this bill has the data minimization protections I discussed, and also a global opt-out so that consumers can opt out in a single step. In Virginia, you know, the opt-out would be largely unworkable for consumers. There's also extremely weak enforcement in Virginia and really weak definitions, which wouldn't meaningfully rein in Google and Facebook. That law is expected to go into effect in 2023. And also, you know, data brokers and others are working to weaken that law before it goes into effect. And then Colorado has also adopted a privacy bill that will go into effect in 2023. You know, much better than Virginia. I don't think it reaches the bar set by California, and this bill would be significantly stronger, both in enforcement definitions and the data minimization protections.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And since we would be having the strongest protections of any of the states, is there any concern that, you know, some of these companies might, you know, look at our population size and say, gosh, you know, we've got to do all these new things and harder things and follow these regulations, so maybe it's just not worth it to us to do business in Alaska. Conversely, how do we prevent these protections from keeping, you know, a young, new startup Facebook from trying to compete if they have to compete with, you know, 50 different sets of laws and so forth, and maybe they just decide never to start in Alaska?
Yeah, through the chair, the concern that these would be onerous has not been raised. And actually, when you look at the requirements, they are very common sense and were recommended by people who've worked in and around the industry for a long time. So haven't heard that concern, don't see a reason there would be that concern. And frankly, I think if consumers have confidence their data is being protected, that's ultimately good for the marketplace. That'll encourage more participation.
Representative Kirky, did you have your hand up earlier?
I didn't, but I do have a question.
Well, either my eyesight wasn't working, but you're in the queue and you're up.
Yeah, so I appreciate the intent behind this bill immensely. I think it's needed. What I'm a little bit baffled by, maybe I just need to thoroughly vet it here. Typically when we see bills, you know, there might be couple lines, sometimes a couple paragraphs. If it's significant, maybe a couple pages, but this is a lot of pages of not amending code, but literally new statute be put on the books. And I understand we're going in something, somewhat of uncharted territory for Alaska, but my concern is that in our effort to provide this protection for consumers, we're going far beyond just providing protection for privacy, but now we're making this massive new law that is over the top on a lot of stuff. I guess would be my concern, because just the sheer volume of code seems enormous.
Yep. Through the chair, I think part of it is just a reality that technology has advanced so much faster than our statutes over the last few decades. I mean, we didn't pass a privacy law in the 1990s when internet use was becoming more common. Maybe if we had, this would be a more modest update. We didn't pass one in the early 2000s. So I think we're just so far behind technology that anytime you fall that far behind technology and technology changes, you're going to need more words just to describe what the intent is. Mm-hmm. I think it's also a practical reality that given the number of places that consumers interact online, something like a global privacy control, you know, a signal on your phone that says, hey, don't track me. If we don't identify that in the bill becomes much harder to make effective. So we could take out that language, but we would sacrifice efficacy. And, you know, I think you always want a shorter bill, ideally, but sometimes with evolving technology, you need a degree of specificity to make sure that the bill achieves your intent.
Uh,
All right, I don't see any other questions, so we're going to turn to public testimony. Oh, okay. We're going to open public testimony on House Bill 159. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 159? Don't see anyone in the room. We have a few people that have called in the off-net. First is Michael Waranecki. I apologize if I mispronounced your name. Mr. Waranecki, if you want to identify yourself for the record, state any affiliation you may have, and today we're keeping public testimony to 3 minutes, so you can proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Clayman and Vice Chair Schneider, as well as members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. My name is Mike Waranecki. I'm Chief Counsel for Tech Policy at the Entertainment Software Association, and we're the Video Game Industries Trade Association. I appreciate the chance to testify today on HB 159. My main point today is to emphasize that video game industry has long made a priority on children's privacy. It is something that has been core to our industry's products for many years because of the nature of what they are and the online focus increasingly of video games. And part of that focus has, of course, been complying with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which is a federal law that regulates the collection of information from children under 13. I mention that because our position on HB 159, is neutral, but we do have some concerns with how it interrelates to COPPA, and we'd like to see some changes made so that it's more consistent with that federal framework. Specifically, one, we think that the bill should clarify that a business shall not process data from a consumer under 13 unless processed in conformity with COPPA. Second, that the we have some concerns. There's a it appears that there's a provision in the bill that unlike the federal standard uses actual knowledge, this one has a constructive knowledge. The bill uses a constructive knowledge standard of recklessly disregards the likelihood that a consumer is under 18 for purposes of determining the age, and we'd like to see that to be more consistent with the federal standard, which is actual knowledge. I think the problem with the constructive knowledge standard is when you couple that with the PRA, it creates enormous uncertainty as to what, you know, what exactly recklessly disregard means. And I think the bright line of actual knowledge is something that's worked for the past 20 years, and we think it's a useful standard. And then third, we support an amendment that would clarify that parental consents obtained in conformity with COPPA are sufficient for consent under the bill. Basically, what we mean by that is under COPPA, if you're going to collect personal information for an under 13-year-old consumer, you need to first get consent from their parent. And so we just want to make sure that whatever consents we, our members, would obtain under this law, you know, it would be consistent with the federal law so that they're not having to get separate consents for different laws. So that's those are our three main points on the bill. Again, we're neutral, but we would like to see some modest changes on the children's privacy to make it more in line with federal law. With that, I'll conclude my remarks, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we have David Edmondson. Mr. Edmondson, if you want to identify yourself for the record and identify any affiliation you may have.
Good afternoon, Chair Clayman, Vice Chair Schneider, and members of the committee. My name is David Edmondson. I am TechNet's VP of State Policy and Government Relations. I am here testifying in respectful opposition to HB 159. I will note at the outset that I have not had time to fully review the new committee substitutes to the bill, so my remarks today will cover at a high level the concerns we have with the previous version of the bill that, at first glance, still appear to be in the committee sub. I'll start by noting that TechNet supports the federal standard that establishes a uniform set of rights and responsibilities for all Americans. The borderless nature of the Internet demands a federal policy, and even the most well-designed state statute will ultimately contribute to a patchwork of different standards across the country, resulting in steep compliance costs and consumer confusion. But in the absence of a federal standard, TechNet urges states debating their own legislation to consider interoperability with existing models as the default position. Specifically, states should look to the most recent examples of Virginia and Colorado, which present a clearer, more explicit explanation of consumer rights and controller responsibilities. Instead, HB 159 does look to the California model, which remains a moving target. California businesses and consumers currently live under a privacy regime that was enacted in 2018 and has been interpreted through a long series of rulemakings by the Attorney General's office. But that regime will be supplanted next year by a new authority, the California Privacy Protection Agency, which is tasked with enforcing a 2020 law. That is also the subject of a current series of rulemakings by the new agency. Additionally, we have serious concerns with enforcement being conducted via a private right of action. Under a PRA, any unintentional or perceived violation could result in ruinous liability for companies. For these reasons, no state, including even California, for privacy violations has chosen to go down this path. Unlike the broader class action in this bill, the private right of action in California is restricted to data breaches. The penalties under this bill would enable class action firms to wield the statute as a cudgel against well-meaning businesses to extract significant settlements from companies with little or no actual value delivered to the consumer. Because managing personal data requests are operationally very complicated, accidental and good faith mistakes like unintentionally omitting a category of data received from a third party could be common. And central enforcement by the Attorney General with a right to cure period ensures that justice would be meted out evenly and that enforcement actions are targeted at those causing actual harm to Alaskans and not just those that offer the opportunity for a lucrative settlement. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else in the queue for public testimony, and I don't see anyone new in the room since I asked if anyone in the room. So I'm going to close public testimony at House Bill 159. At this time, we are going to hold. Oh, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And this is for the sponsor or anyone who has information. So on page 10 of the bill, through the chair, we talk about protection for minors. And we require a parent or guardian to give their consent. And I'm wondering how normally would that consent be achieved? Is it just you're asking, you know, the child on their mobile device whether or not their parent consents? And in which case, I would expect most children would just say yes, and then that's it. Or is there something more robust there?
Right. Through the chair, it's a good question, and I think protection of minors is one of the more important things that this bill tries to do, and it's a reality of minors having devices that connect the internet that it's important to make sure that the protection is as robust as possible and can't just click through it. And that's one of the reasons that we have B, a business that recklessly disregards a reasonable likelihood that consumers under 18 years of age, to try to provide some motivation to the companies that are profiting from such information, that consent is real, but we don't prescribe it. And, you know, whether we want to prescribe it in more detail, I guess if members have input on that, I'd be interested in hearing it. I think it get risky to be too prescriptive. Thank you.
Follow up?
I would just note that we have a lot of time left on the calendar, so I'm going to go back to members' questions. I also note if they haven't left, and it looks like they still are on, because the question of my privacy for minors, parental consent, was actually touched on by Mr. Warnecki. And so to the extent you have questions for either of the two who provided public testimony, we can certainly direct those questions to those individuals. But I will reopen for questions, and we can have some of these discussions. Representative Eastman, follow up.
Thank you. And so I see from the way that the bill is laid out on the minor protections that once consent's been achieved, then the reckless part wouldn't apply anymore. It's only when they haven't achieved the consent. On subsection C, page 10, line 20, we are going to be restricting a business from tracking or profiling the personal information of an individual who is under 18. I understand where that's going. But is there anything to stop them from tracking the device that minor uses? Because, you know, I could see a company coming back and saying, well, we're not tracking the child. We're just tracking the child's cell phone, in which case doesn't that kind of go to the same thing?
Yeah, through the chair, I think I would probably defer to Terry Bannister, the attorney who drafted this, to talk about the crafting of the language to make sure that we don't have a loophole like that.
Ms. Bannister. Welcome. Did you hear Representative Eastman's question?
If you could perhaps repeat it was quite long.
Thank you, and through the chair. So on page 10 and line 20 of the bill, we're going to make it prohibited for a business to track or profile the personal information of an individual who's under 18 years of age. And I'm just wondering, that sounds good, but are we leaving open the possibility for a business to track or profile the electronic device of an individual who is under 18 years of age, at which point they're not tracking the individual, but they're tracking all of their activity, at least on that particular device?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I would think that this language might not address that specific point. It's very broad, and it could be considered to, I think it would cover anything, any way that they would track the information of an individual, of the minor. I would think it would. But if someone is concerned that it doesn't fit more specifically, then the bill could be, and the provisions could be made more express or clear.
Thank you.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this question's for Representative Fields or Ms. Mahoney. In one of our just now previous testimonies, I think it was the last one, expressing concern about the possibility of 50 different states having slightly different rules. And at first blush, I find it a little funny, this coming from companies that broker hundreds of thousands of individuals' data, which each person probably has hundreds and thousands of data points, and they're able to manage that and utilize that pretty easily. And then to hear that, but 50 states would be too difficult to navigate. I'm curious, am I missing something, or I'd be curious what your take on that is.
Through the chair, I think it's laughable and cynical. These companies provide services in hundreds of countries, have no problem navigating them. It's frankly not that uncommon for tech companies and TechNet to say, you know, basically, oh, state government, that's, we don't have time to mess around with you. We're not, you know, they see themselves as above the function of democratic government. I think that's abhorrent. But as a practical matter, yeah, of course they can deal with 50 states. And by the way, if they really wanted a strong federal law, I'm sure Congress would pass that if tech companies would get together with, you know, Consumer Reports and organizations like that. Of course, Congress has not passed such a law because these companies that are profiting from misbehavior don't want a federal law like that to pass.
And I'd recognize that 215 or 213 Representative Vance joined us. Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Thank you. To follow up on that, you know, it strikes me that if I was a Facebook or an Apple or one of the larger multinationals, that these types of bills passed in all 50 states would be exactly what I was looking for if my goal was to ensure that the barrier to participate in my market was as high as possible, so that any new startups would not only have to compete with me on my services, but would also now have to secure passage of the regulatory burden of creating the resources to identify the 50 different states, legal, you know, resources, attorneys, and so forth. And I'm thinking that might be hard for a startup with limited capital to be able to do. Have you considered that?
Representative Eastman, I think the opposite is true. The oligopolistic position of these large companies has enabled them to crush competition, and it has not been any sort of regulation that has limited competition. And in fact, when you look back, and there's been a lot of analysis of this, federal intervention to prevent monopoly behavior by Microsoft is part of what allowed Google to grow. So I think we actually have a pretty long record that robust regulation is necessary for competition.
So I have I'm not sure whether this is for, well, I'll put the question out there. On phone bills, it's quite common for these family plans to come in. And so you get a deal. Here's the family plan. And that means you can have, you know, a family with two parents and three children, they'd get a family plan. And so they get one bill a month, and it probably comes under the name of one of the two parents. how do the privacy relation, how do the privacy provisions that relate to minors affect what would appear to be five phones in the name of Matt Clayman, for lack of a better example?
Sure. I think the answer is pretty straightforward. These companies definitely know who's using each phone. All, it's a reality that most minors, I think above the age of 10, certainly teenagers, all have their own phones, and the companies are very aware of who has that phone based on their social media apps and so on. So I think they already have that information.
But you should correct me if I'm wrong, but like if it, well, I only have two kids, so if it's our family plan and it's listed under my name, I don't think there's any place where I identify who has which number to the phone company, or do I tell the phone company that, or Mr. Singh been able to answer to that? Because apparently I don't. But.
Yeah, so let's say a hypothetical, Chair Clayman had a 15-year-old daughter named Rachel. All the companies that we would be regulating this bill would know that Rachel had that phone because she would have her Facebook profile and her Snapchat and her TikTok and her Instagram all being used by that device. So it would be very obvious to the companies that have this data.
So to some extent, the answer is that the fact that the phone company doesn't know who's on number X doesn't really relate to what you're doing here, because it's a question of who's using it and who knows they're using it.
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions? All right. Representative Easton, you're almost out of opportunity. We're not out of time, but go ahead.
Thank you. Well, you,
I was just about to go on
question.
To settle
I just wanted to build on that. You know, it seems to me that if I had a business relationship with Facebook, I would have access to all that information. I would know, you know, what profile was going on which device. But if I didn't have that pre-existing business relationship with Facebook and I didn't have access to Facebook's data, how do I find out, you know, that Rachel's phone is Rachel's phone?
Just for the record, I do not have a daughter named Rachel, but I appreciate discussion of Rachel for purposes of this matter.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think as a practical matter, people, including minors, primarily access the internet through mobile devices, and it's obvious who's using the mobile devices because of their respective accounts. But in terms of additional detail on that, or maybe nuances of technology with which I might not be familiar, I guess I just ask if Ms. Mahoney wants to weigh in and whether there are other lessons about sort of how we follow this.
Well, before you get Ms. Mahoney, your staff has raised his hand in response to this question. So, Mr. Walsh, identify yourself and please proceed.
Tristan Walsh, staff representative Fields, for the record. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, even if one does not have a first-hand relationship with Facebook, that is one of the largest data resources out there, just given the billions of people who use it. And so a survey of the Apple or Android store found that I think something like 60% of the apps there have plugins with Facebook. So you don't not necessarily have to be a Facebook user for your information to be in their universe. And that's where a lot of the privacy concerns stem from, and that multiple states are addressing, is that you don't have to be a particular customer, a particular company, but your information has the ability to be in a very broad second and third hand market.
All right, Representative Drummond, every time I'm about to wind up, somebody raises their hand, which is good.
That's the whole point, isn't it? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to how the permission of the parent is going to be obtained prior to the child's access to whatever website they're seeking to explore. For example, my own experience with, say, the website of a Malaga distillery down the street or a marijuana business, they always ask you if you're over 21. I don't see, you know, nobody's asking me if I'm the parent or anything like that, and it doesn't seem to have any ability to stop, say, my grandson borrowed my phone. It doesn't have the ability to stop him from entering that website. How in all practicality, does that work to keep a child from accessing a website where they shouldn't be?
Thanks to the chair, Representative Drummond. I think the honest answer is it's going to evolve. So you're already seeing a lot of devices where you log in with a thumbprint or something like that. So we're going to see increasingly precise access to devices with biometric information. And that is going to make it simple. Whether technology evolves to a point that there's some other way that it's more practical, I don't know. But yeah, the bill, like we discussed earlier, doesn't prescribe exactly how these companies need to have that confidence that it is in fact a minor.
And one additional follow up. I'm actually not in relation to the access of a child. I'm looking at the Article 1, Section 22 on page 3 of the presentation. The right to people of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. I'm glad the legislature is implementing this section through this bill. But suppose we have a constitutional convention and there is a move made to change our very strong right to privacy. Will that impact how this bill is implemented, or, you know, suppose it's implemented? The Constitutional Convention impacts won't be known for a very long time, or won't be implemented for a very long time. But how would that impact the power of this bill to protect Alaskans?
Sure. Through the chair, unless a new constitution specifically took away our right or our ability to legislate, precluded our ability to legislate, we still could on privacy. And you know, some of these other states that have legislated don't have such strong privacy protections in their constitution. And, you know, if it's not addressed by the constitution, then the state has flexibility in that regard if they're not preempted by some other federal authority. So I think we would still have the right, and I think we would still have an obligation in terms of protecting people's privacy, but we would no longer have a constitutional directive. Whereas right now, I would argue we've got a pretty strong constitutional directive.
Thank you.
All right. Going. We'll hold this bill for future review, and we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Wednesday, February 9th at 1:30 p.m. We will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:22.